Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, over 500,000 Americans are currently homeless. What is causing this crisis? And what are the solutions? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Approximately 17 people per 10,000 will experience homelessness in the United States at some point in their lives. There are a little more than 500,000 homeless peoples in this country. And homeless persons have a shockingly low life expectancy of around 50 years. Across the nation, the numbers seem to be rising, and rising before the pandemic, though the pandemic has raised issues, increasing visibility, and increasing the challenge, not just to the community, but certainly to the people living on the streets. The issue always seems to get special attention during the holiday season, and this one is no different. And this holiday season as well, we're getting reports, at least out here in Los Angeles where we record, that shelters are filling and the resources the city is providing are strained. And our new mayor, Karen Bass, declared a state of emergency on the issue on the first day of her term, fulfilling a campaign promise. On today's show, we will explore the causes of homelessness. We're going to talk about some of the discourses on homelessness, and I suspect puncture some myths, and talk about the social, medical, and human crisis it represents, as well as evaluating some of the proposed solutions and perhaps exploring others. Our panel today is Deborah Padgett. She's professor at the NYU Silver School of Social Work. She's the co-author of Housing First, Ending Homelessness, Changing Systems, and Transforming Lives with Benjamin Henwood and Sam Samberis, and Homelessness, Housing Instability and Mental Health, Making the Connections. And Paul Toro, professor of psychology at Wayne State University in Detroit. He is the co-author of Research on Homelessness and Mental Health, What We've Learned from the United States and Nations in Europe, and Homeless Youth in the United States, Recent Research Findings and Intervention Approaches. Thank you both very much for joining us. And Deborah Padgett, I'll start with you. There's a lot of conversations about what's the cause of homelessness. So I'll give you the deceptively simple question. Why do we have so much homelessness?
Oh, that is a simple yet very complicated question. So we have a homelessness problem that basically dates to the 1980s. And it's no coincidence that that was Ronald Reagan's presidency. And so to move fast forward, I will just say the causes of homelessness from where I'm sitting is a lack of housing and available housing. What I like to do sometimes is distinguish between proximal and distal causes. Proximal causes are the ones that most people seize on readily. They see drug abuse, they see mental illness, they see all of these what appear to be behavioral causes of their homelessness. But the distal causes are these forces that are sort of embedded in our institutions and have become much more exacerbated since the Ronald Reagan era, in that the federal government basically stopped building housing and left virtually all new housing up to the private sector, private developers, who are, let us say, not very eager to provide housing for the homeless. That's my short answer.
So, and Paul Toro, that's always seemingly, you know, one of the huge challenges. I know here in Los Angeles, that's become a significant issue. How much is the homelessness crisis? First of all, how much is this driven by mental health issues? We always hear that once the facilities, mental health facilities closed, especially mandatory sending of mental health patients to those facilities, and how much of it is just basically an economics issue on not enough affordable housing.
Well, both play a role, but I agree with Deborah that we have to look at sort of things that are kind of the immediate causes of homelessness in an individual person's case, and what's the larger social context that creates this problem. And it's a different way of thinking. You know, when you think across countries and so forth, you know, and over time, where things change, the overall problem of homelessness has been changing to some degree. And if you look across nations like I have, and try to estimate the prevalence of homelessness across different nations, you find that there's big differences. Well, why is that? Well, it's not because people drink too much in one country, because they drink too much in another country too. And it's not because of mental illness, because there's mental illness everywhere. It's not like, you know, these nations that I've studied in Europe and so forth are that much different in terms of mental illness, you know, things like schizophrenia and severe depression and so forth. Yet there are differences in the rates of homelessness across these countries, quite, you know, major differences.
Hmm. So Paul Toro, I mean, you studied across countries. Is the United States uniquely challenged with homelessness, or sort of where does it rank compared to, say, some of its European, you know, European countries, Canada, et cetera?
Yeah, we've looked at 11 different nations and had comparable methods to estimate prevalence. And, you know, the U.S., Canada, and U.K. are the leaders here in terms of the rate of homelessness. Other nations like France and Germany, Czech Republic, a few others are low. I haven't gone to Scandinavia, but I suspect it's low there too. So why is that? You know, in those three countries I mentioned, U.S., Canada, Great Britain, you were talking about 7% of people have at some point in their life been homeless in the past. We're not talking about the future. We're talking about the past. Whereas in France and Germany, it's like 2%. So why is that? Well, there's got to be some reasons for it. And it's not mental illness, I don't think.
I guess I'll then follow up. Do you have some initial, you know, some thoughts, some, you know, things from your research that offer some suggestions as to why these, you know, Anglo countries seem to be more prone to it?
Well, I would look at the other countries that are low too. I think there's, you know, family cohesiveness is an issue. So, you know, many of these nations in Europe that I mentioned are low because of their kind of focus on family and community. Poland has a relatively low rate, much lower rate than we do, and they're a relatively poor country, and still they have less homelessness than we do. Well, why is that? You know, it's partly the kind of social and community fabric. Social services and you know, human services in general, medical care and so forth. In those countries, in many of those countries in Europe, they have guaranteed health care for all citizens. You know, we've been moving that way slowly, but we still don't have universal care as they do in, you know, many of those European countries like France and Germany have a wonderful healthcare system and social service system, a safety net for people who are in trouble compared to our system.
Deborah Padgett, since Paul Toro just kind of highlighted healthcare as an issue, and we know that healthcare issues are typically cited as a cause of homelessness, mental health issues, certainly issues like, you know, like substance abuse and drug addiction. How much, sort of speaking social scientific terms at this point, how much of the variants, how much of the causes of homelessness are really driven by public health policies, public health decisions, public health delivery?
I was just going to say right off that the surveys have been fairly consistent that about 30% of all homeless people have a serious mental illness. By that, I mean schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or major depression. That's not to say many higher percent are anxious and depressed, because who wouldn't, who's living, you know, day to day. The percents or prevalences are higher for drug and substance abuse. But again, we don't have enough information to know how much of that was prior to the person becoming or happened subsequent to, because many of the places where homeless people are kind of tolerated also have drugs available in local places. So to me, it would be extremely inaccurate to say mental illness really has much to do with homelessness, because most seriously mentally ill people are not homeless.
I think we want to think about, you know, there are factors that determine who is homeless, like substance abuse, mental illness, and other deficiencies we can think about. And then there are factors that are the causes, you know, more structurally, the big causes that lead one nation, for example, to have a higher rate than another nation.
Or you can look at states. You know, the recent book by Greg Colburn and the others in Seattle is titled Homelessness is a Housing Problem. And, you know, if you say poverty is underlying it, which of course it is, but why is there so few homeless people in Detroit? You know, it doesn't map on. The one thing homeless rates map onto are high housing costs and low availability of housing. So that's how Houston has become the most recent poster child for success in adopting Housing First and in reducing dramatically their homeless population is because their zoning laws are more lenient and they have more of a housing stock. So until we can get that, I don't think California or New York can do much until they increase the availability of housing. I know it's an easy thing to say and very hard to do.
And so, Deborah Padgett, I'm going to follow up on that, that the a lot of the proposals out here in Los Angeles have been to try to build things like bridge housing, you know, some sort of temporary housing. Part of the challenge for that, of course, has always been pushback from neighborhoods. They don't necessarily want that housing there. But it also seems the temporary nature of it, if the city can argue that, I mean, this really is meant to be temporary, you know, that living there for 6 months until you can find someplace, you know, to put them, you know, more permanently. But I mean, Los Angeles is famous, and New York as well, for these insanely high, you know, housing costs. So I guess the question here then is, are we spending too much time focused on things like bridge housing and temporary solutions and not nearly enough time thinking, not nearly enough energy towards more permanent solutions?
Yes. And I think New York is a prime example for this in that we've had the right to shelter since the late 70s, early 80s. So over the decades, it's, you know, almost getting on 30 years and longer, New York has put almost all of its assets into building shelters. And so unlike California, most of our homeless people, the vast majority are in shelters. But we also still have 3,000 plus on the streets. And these are very articulate people who can tell you how awful the shelters are in New York City, you know, the whole shelter system. But we spend over $3 billion a year in this city on those shelters. And the mayor recently said they're going to trial a pilot test of Housing First, which I find kind of interesting since Housing First started in New York City. But basically, they're going to try with 80 people to provide them direct access to supported permanent housing and then provide them with the services they need to stay housed. And that's really what Housing First is.
Yeah, the real trick is to have some permanent housing for people. Idea of having temporary shelters in California to take care of the overflow, what's the next step after that? I'd like to talk about the example of Finland. I know Deborah knows about this example too. They've basically gotten rid of homelessness. And how did they do it? By essentially guaranteeing housing to everybody. All citizens are guaranteed some kind of housing. It may just be, you know, a one room apartment in it used to be public housing or something. It's nothing fancy, but they're not homeless. They're putting people into permanent housing directly. And, you know, if we had the will to do that, I mean, it seems like to many people, I think, as a kind of a giveaway. Why are we giving free housing to people or low cost housing to people? Well, the alternative is to build up your shelter system and do that, which, you know, I think Deborah and I are both not supportive of. It's not a direction that's really going to solve this problem, even in California. Now, we have a great opportunity. You know, what's been going on with the mayor of Los Angeles, I think, is great. It's an opportunity to take advantage of this situation and to say, okay, let's actually do it right. Let's see about how we can create very low-income housing on a pretty large scale. How are we going to do it? You know, setting up shelters is not going to solve it because the next day after they leave the shelter, they're still homeless.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Scholar Circle. scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker, and we're discussing the challenges of homelessness with Deborah Padgett from NYU and Paul Toro of Wayne State University in Detroit. Deborah, you wanted to respond to that as well.
I'm agreeing with Paul, basically. I think it is daunting to think of what it will take to start with bricks and mortar and actually produce housing that's not so different from the housing that we have in New York, which are, you know, large apartment buildings. What I've found in looking at where housing first has worked the best, besides Houston, is Milwaukee. And Milwaukee is a good example of a place where all of the institutional stakeholders got together. And that included the district attorney, the police department. These are all people who affect homeless people's lives, not just shelter operators, you know, or food banks or soup kitchens. But, you know, homeless people have criminalization imposed upon them because of doing what they do in full view and being given violating ordinances and forced into fines and this kind of cycle. And so if you get the district attorney, you get the police involved and you really work together, it's really pretty amazing to me. I mean, you do need kind of a champion, a local champion, someone who really has some vision, who's willing, but they can come from a lot of different places. But right now, it's, to me, we're in this kind of ironic phase of there's never been more interest in housing first, but at the same time, from some corners, there's a great deal of criticism of housing first. So it's both seem to be reaching the kind of peak fast.
And Paul Toro, you know, thinking about one of the things Deborah just said was the need for kind of multi-stakeholder, you know, a real coalition here. I know here in Los Angeles, one of the big issues has been the criminalization of the unhoused and, you know, how that approach sometimes it gets justified as you can get people who need treatment for mental health or substance abuse, where they need to go. But what has been the impact of this move towards criminalization of the unhoused? Has it been positive?
Well, I mean, I think like Deborah mentioned, there may be greater awareness that this happens, but are we doing anything about it? Not so much. But you know, that's a blip on the scale here. Again, I'm sure Deborah would say this again too. We need housing, low income housing. We don't need expensive housing. We need low income housing. A lot more of it. And in places like Los Angeles and New York City, we would need tons of it. In Detroit, we're a little better off, but not so much really. So, you know, that's the trick. But the real long-term trick to being a Finland or being a Houston or being a Milwaukee is being able somehow to get people together to really create more low-income housing. And then, you have to deal with some of them may have mental illness. Some of them may have substance abuse problems for sure. And you have to cope with that. But, the housing first approach that Deborah has been associated with has shown that you can still give people housing first and then deal with their mental health and substance abuse problems later. Get them permanent housing first and worry about that. That's the hard part.
And save money, may I add. That the housing first approach compared to the costs of shelters in this city costs less. And so it kind of amazes me that people talk about the cost of ending homelessness. We are paying those costs every day.
Yeah, through the justice system, right. Through jails, substance abuse,
hospitals, emergency rooms, tremendous costs. Every day we're paying. So doing nothing or doing what we continue to do is costing us a lot of money with nothing but negative results.
Yeah, it comes out of multiple pockets, so it doesn't seem like there's tons of money, but in fact, if you put all together these different sources, as some people have done, I've looked at this before, you find that there's a lot of money going into the average homeless person, not just in terms of shelters, but the food, the cost that Deborah was just listing. All those things, put them together, and homeless people are costing a lot. And if they have mental health problems or substance abuse problems, they cost even more.
Now, on a cost question, Deborah, you highlighted that the homeless crisis really begins in the 80s and this move towards privatization of these services. That was sold politically by Reagan and Reagan supporters, that it would be cheaper, that governments always waste money and they're not as good at it, et cetera. But we hear reports, again, from Los Angeles, I'm imagining it's true across the country, about just how expensive each unit that's built for the unhoused actually cost at one point over $1 million per unit in Los Angeles. What's going on that's making that so expensive?
I think the whole area, and this goes back to the 80s as well, of developing and building housing has become encumbered tremendously by getting building permits, getting environmental waivers, changing zoning is a huge issue here, because much of the United States is zoned only for single family dwellings. And it was viewed as the most, aligned with American values. But when you have the inability to even build new housing in large swaths of this country, where are you going to put this out? So we have these layers of obstacles that we've got to find ways to push beyond. And all I can say, like I said, is we spend over $3 billion a year in this city on homelessness, directly on shelter services. I'm not talking about anything other than shelter services. And that comes out to over $3,000 a month for a shelter bed. Now you can get a halfway decent apartment even in New York for $3,000 a month. So, the irony and the disparities are just really hard to abide.
And so Paul Toro, with that in mind, then you could do this much more efficiently. Turns out that the private sector may not be all that great about providing it cheaper than the government was. And that was always the ideology of the 80s. At this point, is the solution at some level, perhaps deceptively simple, but clear, that we just need more effective government control and much less reliance on private private developers at building the housing?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think more of not-for-profits. I think some of the more interesting things that are going on, though usually on a small scale, are done by not-for-profits rather than, government running these new kinds of permanent housing. Here in Detroit, for example, there's one church that has these little houses. I mean, there's sort of a movement among people in general to have these teeny little houses. Everybody can have their own little single family unit, and it has a little teeny yard. It's like designed for one person, maybe two. And everything is in this teeny little house. I mean, again, here in Detroit, there's 20 of these houses or something. I mean, we need thousands. But I think we need to be creative, thinking about different options that would be permanent housing. It could be done on more of a shoestring so that we're not spending more than $3,000 per unit to build them, or it becomes outrageously expensive.
So Deborah, now the challenge is, that seems to be a zoning issue, because that gets talked about all the time. We need the tiny houses, the 150 square feet, 200 square feet or whatever, that may not be the most cost effective, but zoning says it has to be a single family home. So that's where the whole tiny houses issue is coming from, that it's just a challenge in zoning to allow for multi-unit properties. Is that fair to say?
I honestly don't know the answer to that, but I can say that shipping containers and sheds are not my ideal outcome here, and maybe for emergencies, but they're really just delaying some more substantive solution to ending homelessness. And so to the extent that they're done, that's fine, I guess, but it's really not addressing the problem in any lasting way.
But it's much better than have to stay in a homeless shelter. I'd rather stay in one of these tiny houses myself and have it be mine. I mean, they have kind of rent to own, these little houses.
Well, during the pandemic.
I don't think it's necessarily the greatest solution either, but it's a lot better than being a homeless shelter and building more homeless shelters in LA, where, again, you have the opportunity right now. Now is an opportunity to do something different.
Yeah, I was just going to say, during the pandemic, we got very excited over the prospect of all these empty hotels, and particularly hotels like Embassy Suites that already have built-in kitchens and two rooms and that kind of thing. And so many of us on the East Coast were saying, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Let's take some of these hotels that are at least zoned in the right areas and convert them. And for reasons I still don't know, this city did nothing, really. I think one hotel, maybe, but really didn't do that. I think California's tried to do that. And I think that's where you're hearing some of these outrageous costs, which are built in, you know, to a system predicated on billionaire developers, you know, who can afford to pay those zoning permits or the variances and all of that. But it seems like that time has already passed, and it kind of saddens me, because a year ago we were very enthusiastic about the hotels as a conversion option, kind of like single room occupancy, but nicer than that, as a way to give people a, you know, a decent home.
And of course, what you just said, the irony that one of our candidates for mayor, you know, Rick Caruso, lost to Karen Bass, hit one of his main arguments is, I am a billionaire developer. You need a billionaire developer to develop housing. And LA had rejected that for, you know, several reasons, but that was kind of a compelling argument. So I guess, I mean, at least at one level. So I guess, is that the secret? Do we just need people in positions of power that know how to build, with the assumption that, if, I mean, what Rick Caruso has built is very expensive housing and malls and everything else, but has, I suppose, some degree of expertise at navigating the system to build things? Or is that a false promise? I'll ask Paul, I'll ask you that first.
I don't think we need big developers to do this. You could do it. I could do it. Deborah could do it if we had the resources and the power to say, well, we're going to build this this housing unit that has 100 units, and we're going to do what we have to do to get the building permits and so forth, and we're going to make it for poor people. Mm. You know, half of them can be for poor and homeless people, and the other half can be market value, or, you know, this kind of model that supportive housing is used.
Also subsidize the developers. Not only do we leave it up to them, but we subsidize them with great tax write-offs. And in exchange, these new buildings they're putting out, they're supposed to set aside 10%, let's say, for low income, not homeless people, but lower income people. And that's been on the books for some time, and they are accruing these tax benefits, but it has not proven to yield any substantive number of added building units, you know, to our building stock.
When we come back, how do we get the resources to build the necessary housing to address this homelessness crisis? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How can the U.S. truly solve the homelessness crisis? Why are services to address mental health and addiction essential to resolving this crisis? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Deborah Padgett, who is professor at NYU's Silver School of Social Work, and Paul Toro, professor of psychology at Wayne State University in Detroit. So, Paul Toro, I know you've written that the perception that there's a compassion fatigue on this homelessness or, you know, the unhoused crisis, you know, is a myth. This has been out there for a while. We've been talking about this for decades. And I know there's at least a frustration that we haven't been able to address it. But how generous are people, particularly here in the United States, at trying to provide the resources necessary to do the sorts of things we've been talking about?
Yeah, well, there's been a number of surveys of the general public that have been done asking about homelessness, you know, the representative samples of all people, polls, if you will. We've done a bunch of those ourselves. We're doing another one right now. But the truth is, based on any metric of defining what compassion fatigue is, including asking people, still, do you feel compassion fatigue? No, people don't. And they'll still pay more taxes to help homeless people. That's an item that I find very much a bellwether. If you'll say you'll pay more taxes, that's a dirty word. If you pay more taxes for the homeless, then I think you got some compassion going on there. So who's had compassion fatigue is the media. The media started using these terms back in early 90s, you know, when the kind of big rise in interest in homelessness in the late 80s into the early 90s was going crazy. New York Times had, on average, in 1987, one article per day on homelessness, sometimes two, you know, but the average was one article a day. So, you know, that's dropped down. But again, it's the media, I think, that coined this term. And the media had some compassion fatigue because they'd been studying homelessness, you know, looking at homelessness for a decade, and nothing was getting better. And I agree, it wasn't getting better. Then I guess that it's because public is not concerned about this problem. Well, not really. The public is still concerned. They don't know what to do. They have, you know, I've written about the myths about homelessness. You know, there's still lots of myths and so forth, but still, people don't have compassion fatigue. That's an illusion.
Hmm. And Deborah, then, I mean, what's being described as compassion fatigue might actually be more just simple frustration, because I know in Los Angeles, again, you know, we've passed numerous, you know, we've agreed to pay more or bonds, and we've provided a lot of money to try to address the issue. And it just seems to be getting worse. So it might not be compassion fatigue. It might simply be frustration that it seems like nobody has an answer to this, to this problem. Is that fair to say? I mean, we're just throwing our hands up going, we're spending and we're not seeing any action.
Right. Well, I mean, I always remind people this has been going on for 30 years, so it's going to take a little while. You can't, you know, you could get high expectations dashed if you, in any way, as a political leader, promise that this will be overnight resolved. But again, I think there is a level of political will, and also, like I mentioned earlier, joint public-private partnerships to really work on this. And to a large extent, as much as we spend on homelessness, as much we talk, the media talks about it, it only recently has it really risen to the occasion of you know, in the top five issues of what people talk about. And it is considered now a crisis. And I agree with Paul, he knows better than I about the compassion. But I think some of this is being stirred up by some of these recent books that are selling a lot of books, and then these new institutes have, you know, cropped up, which is sort of a backhanded compliment to Housing First, that they feel like they need to spend money hiring writers to find things wrong with Housing First. They must be doing something right, in my opinion.
Now, to follow up on that, what has Housing First had high success rates at really stabilizing housing? I mean, I know that there's been this focus on getting people, you know, getting people into housing first and foremost. But sometimes that, even if it's not necessarily bridge housing, it's a bridge towards some degree of stability. Are we starting to see, and I know there's a time lag question for a lot of this, but are we starting to see people really having their housing situations stabilized once they, as a result of these programs?
Yes, I mean, the research data is a mountain high. I mean, we've done so much research and state-of-the-art randomized clinical trials, and they all come in with housing first, residents having 80 to 90% housing stability at the end of the year, and the comparison groups more like 40 or 50%. Now, over time, those percents don't stay as distinct. Study was recently cited from Boston where the differences started to collapse a little, but then they noted that half the sample had died. And that raises a big issue that we're facing in the homeless advocacy and research community is the aging of the homeless population and the fact that homeless services were built, A, to be highly very close, transitional, not of long periods, and B, really set towards families, young families with children, and the chronically homeless. And as you mentioned, the life expectancy is dire, and we see this in homeless people on the street, a lot of medical problems. So even leaving aside the mental illness for a minute, there's tremendous need, medical needs for homeless people as they age. But Housing First definitely works in any sense of the term. And whenever someone criticizes it, I say, give me some evidence of another approach that works better. And none has come forth. So then people rely on they're sick or they're mentally ill or something like that as the catch-all reasoning.
But many of the early studies on Housing First were based on mentally ill homeless people.
They were. Those are the ones only mentally ill.
The 1 year follow up, the majority of them after a year are also still in their housing.
It was developed. You're right. Only for people with serious mental illnesses, and most of whom had coexisting substance using. So my own research has been in those areas of comparing. Using qualitative methods rather than statistics to compare what people's lives are like in the permanent housing sector, people in Housing First departments, with residents in temporary housing shelters and the non-Housing First. And once again, the differences are just stark. It's just simple logic that if a person has a safe place, they can lock the door, feel safe, take a shower. I mean, just basic things we do every day for a homeless person on the street is a struggle. Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the controversy is not whether Housing First works. Like Deborah said, there's a pile of data supporting this. It's being able to do it to scale. How do we do it on a much bigger scale? What Finland is a small country, granted, and they had a couple thousand people homeless and now they have a couple hundred. So it's a much smaller scale.
They put a lot of money in that housing too. I mean,
they did.
The Finland success was they used existing, but they also built rather nice housing. And they also have a better social welfare system. People with mental illness get a stipend. Mm-hmm. Much more generous than what we do on disability, SSI, and that kind of thing.
And it was public housing. The thing that they really ramped up with is public housing. Right. So it is government subsidized housing.
Absolutely.
But they made enough that would, house everybody who's homeless.
Yeah. And so with Housing First, of course, the emphasis is, if you have an unhoused population, they need shelter first and foremost. But we have acknowledged that it's fair to say probably roughly a third of the unhoused population are suffering from some sort of extreme, mental illness. And I know substance abuse, with the important caveat that it's hard to track whether the substance abuse led to being unhoused or if it was something that was developed while unhoused. But it's fair to say a large number of people, have these substance abuse issues. How effective, has this approach been at ensuring that those suffering from mental illness or those needing rehabilitation from substance abuse are actually able to get those services? Paul, I'll ask you first.
Well, again, I'll go to the Housing First literature, and then there's a broader literature than just Housing First, in my view, that supports the same idea that these intensive services work quite well for a wide range of homeless people, including ones with the most serious problems that you're talking about, with serious mental illness like schizophrenia, depression, major depression, bipolar disorder. These are what we usually think of as the serious mental disorders. And, you know, like I mentioned, the Housing First model was developed with that group. That's where Semberis first had the idea of doing this. And he was giving housing right away to severely mentally ill people who are on the streets, and found good results. If you give them their own permanent place and you give supportive services to help them stay there, they stay there.
The services mostly are what are important. You're right, Paul. And where they've said, oh, Housing First, we tried, it didn't work. It doesn't take long to know why it didn't work. Almost always is they didn't provide adequate support services. Mm-hmm. And Housing First has been extended to families now and domestic violence survivors, youth, you know, other groups.
Substance abusers also. Yeah. There have been studies with people whose main problem is substance abuse. And Yeah, it works for them too.
Yeah, Seattle is known for that, you know, especially. But what we found in our own qualitative interviews with folks is that once they had a stake in something, a place to live, it's kind of like Maslow's pyramid, you know, of needs. But once they had this platform or this safe, secure place to live, the incentive went down to use. Now, that doesn't mean overnight. And yes, sometimes the support, it's never housing only, let me put it that way. So the support services are there to take you to rehab if it's time and you feel it's time. But you don't lose your housing because you have these setbacks. And, you know, people are living, the apartment building I'm living in now, I'm sure there's a fair number of drinkers and drug, you know, and they're not homeless. So, I mean, to blame homeless people for doing the things that the rest of us do behind closed doors is, to me, grossly unfair.
So what you're saying then are these proposals that require, whether it's substance abuse or mental ill patients, must go through rehab or must get treatment. One of the essential norms for Housing First is that that can't be a requirement. And
it's,
of course,
harm reduction.
Okay. Are we showing then, this is kind of tied to one of the myths, Paul, that you had talked about whether, you know, homeless people choose to be homeless, kind of tied to that, then drug addicts, you know, some choose to be addicts and don't seek out treatment. When the services are provided, are we seeing a substantial number, in essence, you know, taking advantage of it, you know, changing their mind, or it's, that's not really the mind that's a lot of the people we're assuming that want to be addicts, they don't want to be, they just don't have access to the service to try to deal with that. Is that a fair assessment?
I don't think addicts choose it. The substance chooses them. But for sure, again, there's data showing that this Housing First model works for substance abuse people as well as people with mental illness. In fact, as Deborah said, the very first studies that Semberis did were homeless people who are both mentally ill and substance abusers. Because in fact, if you go out and look at homeless people in general, and you find ones who have a severe mental illness, as we've diagnosed in our studies, most of them have a substance abuse disorder too. It's like you don't have people out there who are only mentally ill without a substance abuse problem, among the adult population anyway. They usually have both. So we're going to deal with substance abuse anyway if we're going to serve homeless people with mental health problems.
But I mean, in terms of the cost, if you look at people in Housing First and the costs of substance abuse treatment, rehab, or the costs, you know, spending a few days in a psychiatric ward, it's still less than if you do nothing. I mean, the expenses in emergency rooms, jails, hospitalizations are much higher than are the expenses of housing and support services. So I just want to emphasize that because people sometimes say they're going to do housing first and they cut corners in the support services. And those are really important. And that's never is housing first with no strings attached. They say that there's strings attached. The housing first client needs to accept a home visitor, you know, a case manager to come in. They go to them and work with them. But what the emphasis is on is choice and sort of self-determination rather than what we saw in the comparison groups, which were literally rules that were pages long of the program of what you must do and what you cannot do. It's striking, the difference.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker, and we're discussing the homelessness crisis and potential resolutions, or at least means by which to try to ease the crisis a bit, with Deborah Padgett from NYU and Paul Toro from Wayne State University in Detroit. And both of you suggested Detroit doesn't have as large, as significant of a homeless crisis as, say, New York or Los Angeles does. I suspect one of those reasons is literally, you know, housing values. That I know Detroit experienced this dramatic loss of population, and there were all these stories about homes were so, I mean, just cheap in, you know, in the city. Is that the biggest difference between, say, Detroit and then New York and LA?
I think so. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, Deborah, but I think she meant that given the poverty level of Detroit, the extent of homelessness is not as high as it should be. And I think that might be true.
That's the new book, that book that came out, Colburn's book, really, is that if you believe that poverty is the root cause of all homelessness, then you would expect to see more homelessness in places where there's more poverty. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the case. Even Chicago has less of a problem. There's no question that New York and California is overwhelmingly where the problem is at its most acute. And sadly, well, I'd say Seattle and Portland, I'd probably put in there too.
And again, it's housing costs that are driving that. Because I mean, there have been numerous stories that have suggested it's some of the spike in homelessness, you know, here in Southern California, were because property values just absolutely skyrocketed, and so people were being evicted. So I guess, has there been a linkage that there were eviction moratoriums as a result of the pandemic? Have things like eviction moratoriums contributed in any positive way towards trying to stem the increase in homelessness? Because of course, our perception is there's a lot more homeless people here than there were in 2019. So the initial reaction is it couldn't have been had that much of a positive effect because there's still a lot more people who are homeless.
I think the bigger structural problems have gone unabated. We might have had some kind of eviction moratorium effect in Detroit. I'm familiar with local service providers who've said to some extent that's true, but they also said a lot of landlords cheated, ignored these eviction moratorium, and still evicted people anyway. And you know, you had to have the tenant find a good lawyer, a good, you know, public service lawyer to pursue it. Otherwise, they just got evicted, and the landlord owned the place, so they, you know, the police aren't going to do anything. So some of it is that, I think. But you know, in California, for sure, everyone agrees that the biggest amount of homelessness, per capita homelessness, is in California, where the housing values are outrageous. Mm-hmm. And it filters down to everybody, including people in low-income housing areas where rents go up even there. Here in Detroit, those rents go up too, but not so much.
Seems like one of the solutions then could be, we could talk about obviously building homes for the people who are, you know, who are currently unhoused, but to try to ensure that we don't have new unhoused populations, to simply provide, I mean, an eviction moratorium is fine, but if the rent keeps collecting, once the moratorium gets lifted, they're going to end up being evicted. Maybe providing resources to help pay that rent. If we're throwing money at it anyway, has there been any study on that where the government is actually providing resources for people who are at risk of eviction.
Yes, housing vouchers, that's what I'm going to say. I mean, New York City actually has supposed free legal advice for families that have an eviction notice. But just in terms of solutions, it's not the end all and be all, but the government, federal government, and I know this is being talked about at the highest level, increase the number of rental vouchers, Section 8 or housing choice vouchers. That is the answer for so many people. And yes, landlords won't take them, but a lawsuit was just began here of something like well over 100 property owners, property management groups were discriminating against voucher holders. And that's against the law here. So they're cracking down on this this practice. And to me, bureaucracy is a big problem. Living in New York, I guess it would have to be. But there was a story here in New York about 2 weeks ago that 2,600 apartments are sitting empty. They're ready. They're reserved for permanent supportive housing, which means people with a disability. And it's just pure bureaucratic snags that leave these apartments empty. So that's what I mean about a coordinated approach. And, you know, everybody focused in the same direction would be, I think, could really close off some of these outrageous kind of bureaucratic obstacles.
Yeah. I need to ask this because I've heard this on so many reports. And I have to admit, I don't fully understand this, but exactly what are the Section 8 vouchers and why are landlords not accepting them? Are they not as good as cash? Is there too much bureaucracy? Why are they not accepting them?
They don't want riffraff. They perceive the clients as the residents who have the voucher as riffraff, and you know they're going to ruin the property value. You know, we could go on the litany of things that they might imagine or might say, but they're basically discriminating against people who are poor, and yeah, they might have a little more problem than the next person.
So
Detroit, they take them. You might have to go through a couple landlords before you find someone who'll take it, but in Detroit, they'll take them. But we don't have enough of them. I would say in Detroit, we don't have enough of those Section 8 vouchers in order to really make a dent.
And they should pay. They could pay more. They could increase because right now it's, I forget, but it's based on a very formal algorithm calculation of the median rents in the area. And what it amounts to is the voucher doesn't pay probably all of the cost of the rent. So you need a nonprofit organization that can help, you know, increase that amount to make it more desirable to a landlord. But oftentimes the landlord, they see the person, they see the voucher, and you do have to undergo inspections of the unit, probably more than normally, to be eligible. So little things like that, they go, well, why should I bother with you when I can get people without these encumbrances?
But it is illegal to not accept the voucher.
It's illegal in New York.
Okay.
I think it's illegal a lot of places.
Probably is.
So it's a question about the political will of city attorneys to actually prosecute these landlords that aren't that refuse to accept it.
Right.
Okay. Very good. So the last question, we just got a couple minutes left. Do we need to provide more resources, or do we really just need to shift the entire structure? I know that's kind of a big question for the last couple of minutes, but I guess I'll ask it more simply. Do we have enough money? Are we providing enough money to try to address this issue, Paul?
No, well, we don't. We need more resources, but we also need more intelligent targeting of these resources. So again, your mayor's thinking that let's build a whole mess of new shelters that will just at least keep people out of the cold for a while. It's not the right way to think about it. It's not targeting where we need the resources. We need the resources on permanent housing, permanent low-income housing. How are you going to create that? If you're not creating permanent low-income housing somehow, actually, this is a criticism of Housing First because it actually doesn't create the housing. And there's someone behind who doesn't have Housing First who's less likely to get the good housing, get permanent housing. But so we need to get rid of that situation where people are without housing, can't afford it, and they, you know, lose their job, they get evicted, they're out on the street. And in Los Angeles, it's horrendous. You need somebody who has a vision that yes, mm-hmm. yeah, it may seem like a handout to some people, but I'm going to bite the bullet and I'm going to mm-hmm. create this housing. I'm going to start with, there's a couple places I know that we could refurbish them and we'd have 200 new units for mm-hmm. poor people and homeless people.
Deborah, we have about a minute left. I'll give you the last word. How do we get the resources?
I completely agree with Paul. And I think it's a matter of priorities. And I think I look at the Pentagon's budget and I look at the tax cuts for the wealthy and the number of corporations that pay zero taxes. And I think if we had a much more sane system of fair taxation and apportioning public monies for public good, we wouldn't have a homeless problem.
Hmm. So it seems like if we have a homeless problem or a problem of the unhoused, I've actually always kind of preferred that term, even though yeah. we use homelessness here. Mm-hmm. If we have a unhoused problems, what we need to do is build houses. Yes. It's a deceptively simple answer because we know the challenges, but it seems like this is an issue we tend to get distracted frequently on really what is at its core. We've been discussing the homelessness crisis, the unhoused crisis today. Our guests today have been Deborah Padgett. She is professor at NYU's Silver School of Social Work, is the co-author of Housing First, Ending Homelessness, Changing Systems, and Transforming Lives with Benjamin Henwood and Sam Samberis, and Homelessness, Housing Instability, and Mental Health, Making the Connections. And Paul Toro, professor of psychology at Wayne State University in Detroit. He's the co-author of Research on Homelessness and Mental Health, What We've Learned from the United States and Nations in Europe, and Homeless Youth in the United States, Recent Research Findings and Intervention Approaches. Thank you both very much for sharing your thoughts and your expertise.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.